And particularly since it was this that encouraged some of the rapid industrialization that made the mass strike movement possible.
Now, very often when you talk to people who don't know very much about Russian history and you say, what are your associations with Nicholas II? Very often people will say, I remember those four beautiful girls in their white dresses, referring, of course, to the daughters of Nicholas II. And I wonder if you could say something about the ways in which Nicholas II and the other czars used family portraits in the images of their families as a way of conveying the sort of purity and innocence and goodness and all of the things that they wanted to associate.
He did that a great deal. And not only did he do it, but it was done intentionally. I mean, it's not sometimes we look back and we see these hundreds of pictures that they took of themselves, which of course were not published at the time, and they are very charming and very beautiful children. But not only, this was also presented at the time in popular pictures in Loop Key, when they appeared at ceremonies and various state events, showing the czar as a family man, and the family man indicating a kind of virtue that the czar possessed. Now, this had been done more or less through the 19th century. But with Nicholas, there's a kind of different side to it. The previous rulers had used the family as kind of the center of the court life of the state, and particularly Nicholas I, but also Alexander III, the family life being presumably a model of morality for the state. Nicholas II and the court, Nicholas II and Alexandra, used it quite the contrary, as something that separated them from the state. The private life at Tsarskoye Selo in the Alexander Palace, they disliked court functions, but they did like to appear in movies, newsreels at the time. They have, and in various pictures showing the closeness of the family, but in non-state functions. In other words, undermining the state, also emphasizing his personal bond in a curious way, a democratic bond with the people as an alternative to the state. So really, he's willy-nilly, I mean, and certainly unintentionally, pulling the rug out under from the existing state structure in terms of legitimacy, because he himself is so antagonistic to it, and he's not, for those who do respect him as emperor, he's not giving any of his charisma, whatever little is left, to the state system.
But didn't all the monarchs of Europe, don't the presidents of the United States even now sort of regularly trot out their families, you know, sort of, here's my wife, here are my children. What's unusual or what's specific about what Nicholas II is doing?
No, this is, well, this follows the general tradition, but he's doing it much more like a democratic leader, which he's not, than a monarch, because he's separating it from the state. He's showing that he too can have a private life that's unaffected by public concerns. Well, the previous emperors really showed the private life of the czar as being absorbed with the state, as being as their involvement in the guards regiments and the court functions and all of these things. The one way Nicholas did show it involved in the state is in the army, in Alexei's, or the navy, either one. But the navy and the army were part of his image, unlike the state administration. It is very much, he's utilizing, and that's one of the interesting things about Nicholas, he uses democratic type appeals as if he can bolster the autocracy, but really he's really undercutting some of the traditional grounding of autocracy by this way, in the publicizing of the autocracy and the release of various doodads with his picture on it, and a popular biography, and showing him to be an ordinary person. He sort of undermines the sense of the kind of superhuman character of the autocratic body, the autocratic figure.
Is there any way that you have of telling how people responded to these images at the time that Nicholas ruled? Because it's one thing, obviously, to look back and to say, well, this is what happened, but is there any sense for how people actually responded to the pictures?
It's very hard to say how they responded, and it's almost impossible to get any general results. Those close to him had no choice but to respond positively, and they did, and they participated in it, and they supported his preconceptions. Those who were liberal, since the society was so divided, bitterly divided at this time, those who were liberals clearly regarded it as nonsense and sentimental trappings on a despotic regime. So it depends. You have the elite culture that was very much alienated from that we know. The general court culture was alienated from Nicholas, and it was separated from Nicholas.
What about the silent majority?
The silent majority, we know nothing about. The peasants tended to put on whatever response was demanded at the same time. They followed a kind of peasant monarchism, unless they were already had become radicalized. But this is a subject I haven't studied. There's work on it, on peasant monarchism and popular mentalities that will have to use different sources, and that is very, very, very difficult, because peasants tend not to leave very reliable expressions of their viewpoints. So it's really impossible to say how the peasants believe. Certainly in the 19th century, peasant monarchism was dominant. Now there's one view, the point that after Bloody Sunday, the Tsar's that Bloody Sunday discredited the Tsar's superhuman aura. And I'm not sure that it did. I mean, there's no. This is a statement that's been made and is in a lot of the books, but it's not based on any kind of what we would say is social scientific research.
Well, let's leave the peasants out of it for the moment. What about people like the merchants, the small shopkeepers? I mean, after all, not everybody in Russia was a peasant. The clergy, the sort of urban middle and lower classes, mm-hmm. they're the ones who eat up all of the stuff about Diana, Prince of Wales, and all of that. So presumably they would have been the biggest audience for Nicholas II,
right. I would presume that a lot of them were loyal, but the percent is very hard to say. I would say, though, that by the time of World War I, it would seem basically his appeal had been largely undermined. Because you see very little enthusiasm for the Tsar in the cities during the war. There's not people are just beginning to do serious research on World War I, and so I can't speak as an expert on this. But the work that has come out has indicated that when they wanted to gain popularity, patriotic, or to raise patriotic feelings, they avoided the figure of the Tsar. So my feeling is that by and large, except for certain conservative groups, certain groups among the clergy, certainly, certain types of merchants who are still traditional, and my feeling is that the society is really changing very rapidly, particularly after 1900, it's changing very rapidly. So, you know, a lot of peasants have become radicalized, a lot of peasants have become liberalized. So I think, and very politicized. So in to get a non-politicized sample of a, you know, kind of mentality in the response will be very hard, but that I leave to future generations. I have reached the end of this particular study.
Well, but you said that the family photographs that Nicholas and his family were so fond of taking of one another, they weren't publicized.
They weren't publicized. No, there were pictures that were official pictures that were circulated in the magazines, that were in the newspapers, and it went through the court, the censors. They were very much publicized, and the Tsar, though he hated to appear at court celebrations and court functions, loved to appear in movies. He loved to watch movies and loved to appear in movies. So, though he was a very private person, it's said, in some ways he's a private person who's very public, and he likes to meet with peasants in the various celebrations. He enjoys them. He thinks he has a particular rapport with the. Of course, they don't threaten him very much. It's very complicated here. The family pictures are are for their private use. I mean, they all have Kodaks and they all go around snapping each other.
Now, of course, all of these pictures are being heavily reproduced in various albums of one kind or another. There was the exhibit in which you took part in Wilmington, Delaware, that huge Nicholas and Alexandra exhibit that sort of surpassed all expectations. Why do people respond so strongly to these photographs? Do you have any idea?
Yes, I have an idea. My view is because he's very much like us. I mean, he's a family man. He's very close with his family. This is and he has a kind of modern sense of separate self. However, this very sense of self is contradictory to the basic concept of emperor. Because the general sense was that up until the late 19th century, the emperor sacrificed his own personal life for the good of the state, for the well-being of society. As a result, they may take their family seriously and show that they're good fathers, but the family itself also was supposed to serve the state. And here he cuts it apart. He's not sacrificing himself for the state. He's enjoying a private life, enjoying the gratifications of private life, of marriage, of fatherhood, the joys of the heart, the Victorian gentleman. You have the kind of narcissistic gratification of the family, taking pictures of each other, taking pictures of oneself, taking pictures of one's progeny. All of this is very close to what we do. And here you have this person who's very close to what we do, slaughtered in the most bloody fashion by the Bolsheviks in 1918. And so it creates a sense of sympathy with him and a sense of horror. Not that it wasn't a horrible thing, it was a horrible thing. But I think this is part of the appeal, in addition to the fact that they knew how to, they had one type of good taste, they were all very beautiful, extremely well behaved, for many people, and very religious and pious. So if you just took them at their family level, there was a great deal attractive for them.
But you're giving the impression that they had the sort of idyllic family life and that they took very little part in state ceremonies. And yet I start thinking now of all of those pictures of the Grand Duchesses dressed up in the guards' uniforms, and they're taking part in various famine reliefs when World War I is going on.
Yes,
Alexandra and her two oldest daughters go to work in military hospitals.
Right.
So
no, they have to part. They're two separate things. After World War, when World War I goes on, then they participate as nurses, which many people in the court thought at first was simply not something that members of the imperial family should do. This again is something much more kind of like a Western European Protestant, which of course she was, the Empress, and not standing, not maintaining their dignity. They did participate; they had to participate. This is a rule, but what I'm saying is that the virtue that he is showing is the virtue of a family man, you see, is the virtue of a close family, not the virtue of a family dedicating itself to the state. The identification of the private virtue taking precedence over public virtue, you see. Not that he didn't also dedicate himself to the state, particularly in the military sphere, and he did participate in ceremonies, but he did so apart from the various members of the court and the institutions, with the exception of the security group. So it is again a question of separateness and establishing his personal virtue. The way they got up chambers in the Alexander Palace was something very much like a bourgeois middle class family, which all the aristocrats were sneering at.
Yeah, but he had a great office in that palace.
Oh yes, no, I wouldn't have minded to live there, but I'm not a great aristocrat.
That's true. Neither am I. How are people talking about Nicholas in Russia now, or rather, what sort of a myth is being created of him, or was created of him after Gorbachev, let's say?
Well, there were various, again, it's very politicized. There was no single myth. There was a myth of, among certain religious groups, of Nicholas the Tsar martyr, the pious Christian who died a death like old Russian saints giving his life for the fatherland. This was one group, and there were nationalist groups who believed this. Then there was a variant of this, which is not necessarily the same groups, that saw the possibilities of an alternative under Nicholas II, because of Stolypin's reform, the individualization of the communal land tenure, though this sometimes did not go over to Nicholas. Somebody like Solzhenitsyn did not have particularly good opinion of, even though he's a nationalist, of Nicholas. So you have pro-monarchical nationalists and anti-monarchical nationalists. And then also there was an attempt to lure pretenders to, and there still is, to take the throne, whose claims were rather illegitimate and were tenuously legitimate at any rate, because by the law of the imperial families there wasn't anyone really who was a pretender. But some Russian officials like Sobchak tried to encourage this, and he brought, what is it, Kirill Vladimirovich?
Yes,
back, and then Kirill Vladimirovich made the mistake of saying that he was for democracy, at which point a large part of the nationalists deserted him. So they had balls in the Winter Palace and everything. But that, I think, went by with the fall of Sobchak. And right now, the monarchy is, and most of the pretenders are sort of died out, though there are all sorts of quacks appearing in Petersburg and Moscow who gain notoriety by claiming some being the son of the Tsarevich Alexei and things like that. So there are all sorts of these wild things that are always present in Russia. But there's nothing serious now. But there are nationalist groups that are still monarchical, but they are only a small part even of the nationalists now.
Right, but you're talking about sort of a consciously political sort of movement, and I'm curious about the sort of general impression.
The general impression tends to be very positive. Except among the more, again, it's not, except for the more critical intellectuals or former left-wing intellectuals, but there tends to be a very strong nationalist group that, and you keep running into people, I don't want to be sexist, but most of them are women, and saying he was such a kind man, such a good family man, such a religious man. Why did this have to happen to them? What did they do to him, you know?
Now, and how does this differ, in your opinion, from the sort of attitude that people have in the West, which is, oh, he was like us, and they were really beautiful, and how awful that they died in this way? Is the Russian reaction any more complicated than that?
Well, neither. I don't know which is more complicated, but they're both complicated in their own ways, but they're different in the sense that this is... people in the West, it's a form of indulgence, gratification, entertainment, while in Russia it's connected with the rather complex questions of national identity, which is a major problem there, and the lack of a viable and respectable political tradition in Russian history is something that all Russians of all persuasions feel very badly. So I can sympathize with the Russians more than with the American artistic, you know, the indulgence in decorative art, which is, I mean, some of the decorative art is beautiful, but the implications of it, there's always a kind of political subtext there that tends to. I mean, the Wilmington exhibition was wonderful and had marvelous things in it, but this doesn't mean that we have to idealize someone who should not be idealized any more than Napoleon should be idealized.
I just, actually, there was something that I thought of, but I can't think. Yes, it's this. That, do you get a sense in Russia that when people look at Nicholas II and his family, that this is the alternative, the sort of the road not taken? Is there any sense of that?
There are some. Yeah, there's some. There's some. But there are also others who know more and who say that, you know, he was like Solzhenitsyn, who was believes in the, and who say that basically he ruined Russia. There's some like that, too. And that, which was the nationalist viewpoint circa 1915, 1916, or 17, or 18, 19. So it's hard to find any kind of unified view. I think Russians are confused about Nicholas, because he was the one alternative. But one sociologist, Seymour Lipset, in fact, has said that he gave some figure. I think it was 11 of the democratic countries in the West are monarchies. I don't know how he got that, but that was the figure he gave. But in many Western states, the monarchy provides a traditional help for a country in transition to a that sort of maintains following the British pattern.
Or in the case of Norway, the monarchy is something that was sort of created nihilo.
Ex nihilo, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and people love it.
Yeah, yes.
Even though it's a totally 20th century thing.
It's totally invented and a consciously and unabashedly consciously invention. In Japan, where industrialization and everything occurred, and what a certain degree of democratization occurred under the monarch. You had this, and in Spain, of course, they had the example of the Spanish king. But they really did not seem to be. The problem is that in Russia is that most people do not believe that there is a legitimate heir, and quite correctly. I mean, I think it's not something that people put much stock in right now. It might help, you know, and it might provide an institution of stability. But the fact of the matter is that the Russian monarchy was a force for instability at a key point, and I think that is the question that has to be answered.
Isn't it ironic that if Nicholas was trying so hard to achieve stability, that he in fact, or at least as you seem to think, that he sort of brought about his own demise?
It is ironic, but it's completely comprehensible. He wanted to bring about stability in spite of all of the conditions and contrary to the social situation of Russia in the early 20th century. So, I mean, it was certainly a kind of utopian answer to this.
Is there anything he could have done?
Well, there's lots of things he could have done. He could have worked with the third and fourth Dumas, which were extremely conservative due to the change in the election laws, and which were completely monarchist, not completely, but I mean predominantly monarchist. He could have worked with them to try to establish some kind of constitutional monarchy, and particularly a time of war where he could have agreed to some kind of ministry responsible to the Duma. But this would have brought in people who were not at all radical, not even liberal, but who were offensive to him because of their legalism or their belief in parliamentary institutions, because he harbored just a tremendous antipathy to any parliamentary institution. So we were thinking, I mean, following the example of the German monarchs in the 19th century and the Austrian monarchs, he could have created a kind of base, a conservative base. But this was simply not reconcilable with the Russian conception of monarchy.
Are you sure? I mean, after all, think of Alexander II and sort of all that people say that he was moving in that direction, and that on the very day of his assassination, the draft of the Constitution was lying there ready to be signed.
Right. Well, he was resisted it to the bitter end. And when he introduced it, the dictator he briefly appointed, Larisa Melikoff, revised the final version in such a conservative way that it was hardly even a consultative. It was governmental institutions with a few elective members of the people. So by and large, his concession done only when his life was being threatened was very minor, and it was done very much against his will. Earlier in the 1860s, he entertained, entertained other conceptions of some kind of participatory government, but then he backed away from them, and said that it was incompatible with the monarchy.
Well, what about this? All of the wives of the czars, and hence wives and therefore all of the mothers of the czars, came from countries where presumably people did or had worked out this sort of a synthesis. England is one obvious example, Germany, etc. So presumably then the resistance in Russia shouldn't have been that great, right? Because after all, there was some personal contact.
Yes, well, the wives in the 19th century were, their role was told to be basically mothers and symbolic figures and not to meddle in politics. This was very much frowned upon. And so the degree to which they could influence anything, I mean, presumably Dagmar, Alexander III's wife from Denmark, was very sympathetic to constitutionalism. And in fact, her father, the King of Denmark, wrote to Alexander, wrote to her, trying to tell her to convince her husband that if Russia wanted a peaceful future, they should introduce some kind of constitution. But clearly her influence on Alexander III, if she had the courage to be critical of him, was relatively minor. But I doubt if she did. She probably knew to keep her mouth shut.
Okay, but what about things like family reunions, where the Russian monarchs rub shoulders with their sort of cousins, etc.?
Yeah, well, I don't think Alexander III, for one thing, he was a very intimidating, imposing personality who made clear his...
Just because he was 6'4 and weighed 300 pounds?
That helped. That helped. And he also had a nasty temper, so altogether. So I don't think they were about to help. And in addition, there were people in the West, in German royalty, who did not believe in constitutionalism and thought it was a mistake. And certainly Wilhelm II was of that group, and he kept egging Nicholas on not to give any concessions. Not that that was a decisive influence, Western monarchs were not universal in supporting constitutionalism by any means.
It's true that European monarchs were not always uniformly enthusiastic about constitutions, but then again, neither are all of the monarchs who are still on their thrones today. Thank you very much, Professor Richard Wortmann, for talking to us here today. And we've been talking to Richard Wortmann of Columbia University.